Okay, we're ready to start now. From my left, we have Glenn Lunny, Flight Director, Jerry Carr, the Capsule Communicator, Ed Pavelka, Flight Dynamics Officer, and Dr. John Dietrich, a Geologist of the Science and Applications Directorate. Pavelka's last name is spelled P-A-V-E-L-K-A. Dietrich's last name, D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H, John. And we'll start with Glenn, who'll...
Okay, before I briefly summarize the shift we've just been on, this is my second conference for the flight. Yesterday was my first one, and I came over here and told you that I was pleased to be over to attend my first conference, and today I'm even more pleased to be here and to tell you what has gone on the last few hours over in the control center and out around the moon as best as we can. I think I'll go over the shift work kind of lightly. I suspect that the best way we can get at what you might want to hear some more about is to get into the question and answer period, and hopefully we have the men here to answer most of what you would be interested in. We came on duty last night, about 64 hours elapsed. We were talking to Frank Borman at the time, and Jim Lovell got up shortly after that. We'd already passed the point of the going into the lunar sphere of influence, so we were falling towards the moon and increasing. Prior to going around the moon, at about 66 hours, we did a dump on the erasable memory. You recall last night that there was some difficulty with one of the realignments of the platform, the one that was done, at about 60 hours or in the late 50s, I forget the exact time. What appears to be the problem is that the optics for an unknown reason at this time actually moved off a little bit from the null, and then that the computer did not know that, and from the since it drives to the stars, assuming that the optics is at zero, it drove to the wrong number once that we knew of, and then when we got into discussion about it, Jim Lovell reported, the command module pilot, that it had done something similar to that in the previous day, and he cleared it up by just reselecting the program and proceeding. Now, the reason we did the erasable memory dump was that it's very likely that this sort of thing is just either an inadvertent or some form of hardware happening that we don't fully understand yet, but can obviously be worked around just by reselecting and doing it again. However, we did want to dump the erasable memory in the computer just to make sure that all the numbers in the computer were right and that there wasn't something subtle going on with the computer that could cause that to happen. We did that, and it was okay. We realigned the platform and used it for the mid-course. We did a couple of realigns on it, so we knew the platform was okay. We'd taken a lot of measurements on the gimbal angles and the accelerometers on the platform. And with the erasable memory, there was no question in our mind that the entire Gene N system was in good shape and ready to do the LOI burn. That was the only area where we had some activity that we had to solve prior to committing to the lunar orbit insertion. All the other systems have continued to perform in the excellent fashion that we have been reporting to you in the last couple of days. At about 67 hours, some 2 hours prior to the actual lunar orbit burn, we went through what you could call, I guess, a rehearsal of the lunar orbit burn, and that we passed up to the commander a preliminary set of data for the lunar orbit burn. He went through the attitude maneuver to the burn attitude. He checked the sextant star, which is just to check that we have as that the burn attitude is correct. He looks in the sextant and sees the star at the same shaft and trunnion angles that we read up. And he also checked the gimbal motors and the drive to the SPS bell, and he read back the response to that drive, so he knew that he had both control systems which can drive the SPS bell. We had some more pad data to pass up. The pad data that we passed up there after we passed up the first lunar orbit insertion pad was mostly precautionary data. As you can see in the flight plan and as you will hear today, we will keep the pilots updated on information which they could use to do a trans-earth injection on both the current rev that we're on and the subsequent rev. So they will have, for example, going into lunar orbit, we wanted to make sure that they had both the data to do a trans-earth injection on the first opportunity after one rev and on the second opportunity on the second rev. The pads went up. Bill Anders was up and around at about 68 hours. He had taken a second all to help go to sleep and get a couple hours sleep. He probably got about 4 hours prior to the LOI activity. We still have yet to get a full sleep report from Bill Anders on the period immediately previous to the lunar orbit burn, but I suspect it'll be about 4 hours. And then the last hour was relatively quiet, actually, in mostly monitoring on the ground and the crew setting up the cockpit to do the burn. The LOS, or loss of signal, to the Earth as the vehicle went behind the moon was very close, as near as anyone can tell, to the numbers that we had predicted. And we stood by for a while, what for many of us was a very long time, it seemed, for the vehicle to come back around the other side of the moon and reacquire. We did reacquire, and very quickly were able to establish that the burn went very well as far as could be monitored on board, and it was soon verified by the tracking that the orbit was just about exactly what we wanted. Ed Pavelka has these numbers. You can discuss them with him a little later. The one thing that was happening when the pilots came from behind the moon was that the evaporator, the primary evaporator, which, as you recall, we will use in lunar orbit to augment the radiators, was not operating properly. What appears to have happened is that the water in the evaporator dried out since the last time we serviced it, which was a long time ago, actually. The lunar module pilot, Bill Anders, reserviced the evaporator and put it back online, and it functioned properly. In the meantime, we brought up the secondary evaporator, and it worked just fine while we were reservicing the primary. Those of you who covered Apollo 7 recall that we went through this cycle several times on Apollo 7. The primary evaporator is now carrying the load along with the primary radiators, and the secondary coolant loop system is off. Just to give you some examples, when we were on the way out to the moon, the temperature out of the radiators was running about 40 degrees. In lunar orbit, because of the reflected heat from the lunar surface, the radiator out temperature is running about 60 degrees, 62 degrees. So we do the final 20 degrees of cooling with the evaporator. And the rest of the activity during that first pass was primarily looking at the data, getting the dump data from the first burn, taking a look at all the parameters that we can on the SPS engine and confirming back to the crew that everything looked okay, and we gave them a go to go around another rev. We also talked to them about the filters for the TV pass. Coming up on the second revolution, which was the TV pass, and which was essentially going when we got acquisition. That pass went normally. Everyone saw the TV, and I guess the best way to proceed on that subject is to wait until we get into questions and answers. I spent most of my time, I guess like Frank Borman did, I was more involved with how the systems were working and how the engine had worked, etc., at that time than what the pictures looked like or some of the description. Also, there was another comment made that was interesting. I have talked about the fact that the radiators were a little warmer in lunar orbit. Another indication of this is that Jim Lovell reported that the ice appeared to be melting on the center window, the number 3 window right in the middle of the hatch, which is an indication of the warmer environment that we're in around the moon. We gave a go for the LOI 2 burn based on our analysis of the engine and the performance of the control system, etc. LOI 2 was read up to the crew, the pad for LOI 2, the burn information, I should say, for the second lunar orbit burn. We did a couple of housekeeping kind of things. We had to cycle the fans and the cryos to be sure that they were in good shape and there was not any stratification building up there. That went okay. Going behind the moon on the second time, I should say the third time behind the moon, the crew did the LOI 2 burn. I left the control center shortly after the discussions we had as the crew came around after that burn. As near as we can tell at this time, that burn went completely nominally. The performance of the systems, again, are nominal. And as far as we can tell, we have a completely go spacecraft. The activity for the rest of the day, in all likelihood, will go pretty much as you see laid out in the flight plan. We have the ribs laid out for photography work, the first couple of ribs, and then 5, 6, 7, and 8, the work on those ribs will be concentrated on the landmark tracking. I'm sure we hope that during the 20 hours off and on, the different men can get a couple hours sleep. Trans-Earth injection tonight. And I'm sure the next shift that comes over to brief will have some more information on the details of the planned nominal trans-Earth injection tonight. A brief statement, I guess, on consumables. We have slowly been catching up on the RCS residuals, on the RCS consumables. When we left the control center, we were in very good shape on the RCS. The work that the pilots were doing in lunar orbit, the tracking, etc., seemed to be running about the kind of numbers we expected. So all that bodes well for the status of the RCS during the lunar orbit. The status of the consumables, the oxygen and hydrogen consumables, continues to be one of a very comfortable posture for us. We can get back to the Earth at the nominal time on one cryo tank in both the oxygen and the hydrogen system at this time, one of the two tanks which we have in each of those cryogenics. I guess that summarizes what we have. I have, I guess, one other thought, which is perhaps more administrative than anything else. We will probably have some questions here today that we can't answer or may not have with us. I suggested to John McLeish last night that for those of you who may have a question which I or whoever else comes over here wouldn't be carrying around in our head, we might be able to better get you the answer if you're able to get them to John or somebody in the PAO a little bit early, because there's only so much we can remember and carry over when we come here. But let's see what we can do today.
Okay, we're open now for questions. Gentleman right here.
Reference was made to a crater called Pickering, and I'm told that there are a couple of Pickerings around on the moon's surface. Do we know what Lovell was referring to?
Yes, it's the pair of craters in the Sea of Fertility that is labeled on... It is a pair of craters in the Sea of Fertility that are on some maps listed as Messier and Messier A, I believe it is, or it may be A and B, but it's a twin pair of craters. An old name for one of them is Pickering. M-E-S-S-I-E-R, I believe.
I would like to make the following question. Are you considering the positioning of communication satellites around the moon in order to avoid the communications block while the, a spacecraft is traveling on the far side of the moon?
That concept has been discussed. However, there are no plans to implement a vehicle to accomplish that at this time that I know of.
I have two questions. One, we got the impression that they had the TV on as they came around from behind on that first transmission. It seemed to burst right in on us, and I wondered if that was the case. The other thing was I wondered what problems have been introduced by the time lag due to the distance. I noticed at one point they had a 1-2-3 mark, and I wondered what that was and whether you cranked in here the time delay that is intrinsic to the distance.
Well, I think that on your first question, I think the TV was on at just about the time of acquisition, and that was all part of locking up the station. As far as the mark goes, yes, there's some difference in the time just due to the speed of light of transmissions. However, it seems to me that the mark isn't off more than a second or two, and generally we're dealing with something that doesn't have to be any more accurate than that. Plus, I guess, mentally anticipated some kind of a discontinuity in conversations, but we don't seem to be having that. Maybe Jerry will comment on that, as busy as he's been at that.
The lag a little bit between question and response, more than when they were near.
That's mostly due to thinking, I think, rather than...
We have tried to crank in a little delta to take account of the time lag. We're allowing 2 seconds, and I think one of the marks that you probably heard was a time hack that I gave them about 8 minutes from LOS going around the corner for the LOI burn. What I did is I started at 12 and counted, called that 10 and counted down, and 2 was marked. And by the time he got it, he was at 0 on his counter. So that's how we did it.
John, what was the atmosphere in the Mission Control Center at the time of LOI? I heard some faint yelling and whatnot.
You mean at what time of that we acquired?
At that time of acquisition.
I would describe it as a sort of a moving drama to me, but I'm not sure I can. Yeah, it.
From inside, it certainly wasn't faint.
No.
I said from the moker itself, it certainly wasn't a faint reaction. There was quite a bit of racket. Quite a stir.
I'm sure it can be described as one of the happiest Christmas Eves just about anybody there had seen. Let's take Art Hill, and then we'll get back over this way.
Dr. Dietrich, as a geologist, what has interested you most about what the astronauts have done so far in their lunar orbits?
Well, they have, first of all, demonstrated their ability to observe from the spacecraft to a degree that I think surprised most of us, because the earlier observations were in an area that we had expected to be somewhat blanked out because of the high sun angle. And the demonstrated ability to observe details in these areas, and of course this improves as you approach the terminator, was most encouraging to those of us that were in the science support area. The ability to observe details at the higher sun angles that were present when the TV came on. Their descriptions were much more graphic, of course, than the picture, because the eye responds better than the camera.
Dr. Meter, can you tell us, as you looked at the pictures, where the TV started in latitude and longitude, and where it terminated? In other words, what part of this lunar track did the TV start and finish?
The spacecraft was oriented, so they were looking back along the path that they had traveled. So they were looking eastward while the spacecraft was traveling generally westward. The spacecraft gave us the first signals at about 110 degrees or 115 degrees east, because it was above the surface. They were looking back slightly behind them. Yes, that's about right. They were looking back behind them along the path that they had traveled, so they probably went out to about 120 degrees or so east with their photo coverage. It took me a while to get organized, so I don't know exactly what was on the first few seconds. I would like to pass that question to the flight crew support.
You want to take that one, Jerry?
Yeah, I'll take that one. As I remember, the first crater he called out was Brand, and that crater is at about 10 south, 125 east. That's right. The craters that we've called Bassett and C were out pretty close together at about 25 south, 110 east. C is just right about on those two, on that point, and Bassett is a little bit further south. Okay, the track I quite frankly don't remember.
They went
to the Terminator.
Mid-C. No, they didn't get to the Terminator.
They went through Smythe C. So that would put it at around something like 5 south, 75 east. That's just a little bit past Smythe C, right around the craters Kastner and Gilbert. No.
They mentioned Mine Green and some of those craters further west.
Yeah, let's wait for the mics if we can.
Has enough time elapsed to get any kind of a determination on the effect of the mass GOMs on the orbit?
Well, I'll let Ed talk about this a little, Ed Pavelka talk about it a little more, but they are detectable. For example, when the vehicle was passing over the some of the major areas like Copernicus, the men in the tracking area look at something that they call residuals, which is just observed measurement minus a theoretical computed measurement, the best one they have at that time, and they could see it a jiggle like noise in the measurement at that time, as if there were a mass concentration effect on the measurement itself, or I should say the theoretical computed compared to the observed. I guess I would also say that it seems to be, although it's very early to tell, that the accuracy that we have on the orbit is pretty good, even with that mass concentration at the moon, about which we do not know too much yet. At least at the altitudes we're flying. So I don't know if I've helped any, but you can see that they're there.
Do you feel they have any effect on future flights landing?
Well, I think the thing that we're trying to learn on this flight is to understand exactly what the effect of the lunar gravitational field is at the altitudes we're at. And hopefully, with the data we get from this flight, we'll be able to work that back in and minimize, if not make zero, any effect like that. Yes.
Physical side of things. Have you had any more tape reports on astronaut conditions? And how did this work-sleep cycle get off right up to the point of the LOI? Jim was the only one resting just prior to LOI, wasn't he? LOI 1?
Prior to LOI, Jim Lovell and Bill Anders had a flight plan allotment of about 7 hours. I don't know how much sleep Jim got, but Bill got probably about 4 hours at that time. And as near as I can make out, we are close to being back on the flight plan sleep cycle, which in lunar orbit is kind of small. But we get off of it kind of in the beginning of the flight when we had the need to sleep more often.
Have you had anything else on their on the condition on their?
No. You've heard everything that has come down on the condition. They all seem to be feeling genuinely better and genuinely more chipper than they were in the early stages of the flight.
Okay, let's take one from behind. Bill Shelton now.
I have a question on the naming of the lunar features again. Could you tell me what criteria were used in selecting these code names, which I understand are not official yet? Approximately how many features are so named, and what liberty or what plan does the crew have for naming additional features at will during this flight?
Well, I guess the first thing we ought to say is that the names that had been put there are very unofficial, I guess as unofficial as you can get, and the requirement really was to have some names for some of these unmarked craters, and they were arbitrary and just a convenient way to call them out. Frankly, I'm glad to stop reading numbers and letters back and forth and glad to hear a name or two.
I want to get back to this to this matter of the track during that television pass and see if we're not a little confused here. If I heard you correctly, you said that the track terminated at about 5 South 75 East, but we kept hearing from these people about the Sea of Fertility, which is at like about 50 East. We heard Masculine, which is at 30 East, and so forth. I just want to get sync with you. Are we talking about the same pass?
Yes, sir, I think we are. I guess I got into a little too much detail there. Now, when we came across the first time, prior to the TV orbit, the second rev, as I remember, the first crater that was named by Jim Lovell was Langrenus.
Yes.
And then they steamed on off the other side. He talked about the Sea of Fertility, Tarantius. Pardon me, Dr. Dietrich, I'm probably messing up the pronunciation. He mentioned the Pyrenees, Gothenburg, and the rest of those, the Sea of Tranquility. That was on the first pass. Then when we came up on the TV pass, remember they came steaming up around the corner, and they had the TV ready to go just as soon as they rounded the corner, and the first one they called out was Brand.
Yeah, fine. That solves my problem.
Okay, then the TV pass terminated at about Gilbert and Kastner in that area, and then if you'll remember, Jim had a few more remarks to make while the TV set was off.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we started picking up those other latitudes.
Now I wanted to ask Glenn Lunny a question. I understood last night that they might make an attempt to duplicate this famous orbiter picture where you had the lunar mass in the foreground and the Earth out in the distance. This wasn't done on this pass. Will they try it tonight at 8:30, do you know?
I don't know, Bill, but I certainly hope so. I'd like to see one of those, too, but I really don't know.
Gentlemen, a second.
Dr. Dietrich, I'd like to get back to one point, and I know the question has been asked to you, but you didn't answer it fully. What were the most interesting, the most revealing descriptions made by the cosmonauts so far of the lunar surface, as far as you're concerned?
Let's put it this way. It has not been a quiet morning for observing what they were doing or saying. We've had other things to do, too. In the descriptions that I caught while moving back and forth around the TV sets, I think probably his description of the interior of the large crater, I cannot find the name now, was it Tarantius, where he saw Langrenus, I believe it was.
Terracing.
The interior terracing. This we have seen on photographs, it's true, but photographs capture a view from an instantaneous position, whereas he was able to observe much more as the scene moved under him. You can tell much more about the third dimension by seeing a moving scene, and I thought that this was one of the things. The other thing that impressed me was that he confirmed the orbiter gray color for the moon. This, we hope, is something that will be rectified in other parts of the moon, but if it's gray, it's gray.
What do you mean, rectified?
Well, he'll find other colors. We have hopes that that we will have some spots, fresh areas perhaps, that will show different colors in addition to having a different albedo, a different shade of gray.
Mark Bloom.
I have two questions. Dr. Dietrich, if I may, was the television at all useful scientifically in any way?
Yes, I think it is quite useful. Now, if you're questioning this in the sense, do we get as good a resolution on the television pictures as we will on the film pictures, no. This is not right. The film pictures will always be better than the television as far as fidelity and the ability to recapture measurements, which, of course, is the name of the game. We need to measure things. I think that they have scientific value very definitely in that we are able to keep track of what is going on. We're able to monitor their progress in the areas where they have these television strips. We are able to ourselves get a little bit of an impression of this moving image that I was talking about him seeing.
Excuse me, I didn't mean from an operational standpoint. I meant from a science standpoint. I didn't mean from an engineering.
Well, for some time to come, that's the only way we will see the image moving under us to get an idea of how it changes with changing angles is by having someone else hold the camera.
And the other question I had was, I remember the one of the three mentioned that he could see other craters, which they named, called Borman, Lovell, and Anders. And I was just wondering whether they were kidding or whether they actually named them, had codes for themselves up there.
Do they have any craters called?
Very definitely. I beg your pardon? The craters Borman, Anders, and Lovell, I think, are appropriately located right together, three, in a little puppy foot. They're located, the center of them is located at about 15 south, 105 east. Borman is the biggest crater, Lovell is the next biggest, and Anders is the smallest.
What's your latest information on the high and low points of the orbits following LOI-1 and LOI-2?
Ed?
Would you ask again, please?
What's your latest information on the high and low points of the orbits following LOI-1 and LOI-2?
Okay, the elements were 60.6 nautical miles by 60.7 following LOI-2, and at the time that I left, we did not have a complete pass of radar tracking data, and this was a preliminary estimate.
Further question on the SPS, why did it burn longer than expected on both burns?
Well, we actually are not surprised if the burn runs 1% longer, which is apparently about the kind of number we ran on the first burn, and just a slight change in the chamber pressure can account for that. So that's not surprising, and it's due to that.
What about the second? 9 to 11 seconds is really more than 1%.
Yes, but that number has to be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt because that burn comes on and goes off so fast that I'm sure 10 seconds looks like 9 to them, so 10 looks like 11, so I wouldn't draw any conclusions from that. The significant thing is that the numbers, the velocity numbers left over in the guidance computer were very, very small, which indicated that we hit exactly the conditions that we had targeted for. The pressures in the engine, etc., are more indicative that the engine is working properly.
F. Clark.
Have you been able to tell from their descriptions and or from the TV how far north of their track and how far south of their track they can see? What's the band that they can observe?
I can feel that one, I believe. They have about 40 degrees, lunar degrees total, from horizon to horizon. if the spacecraft happens to be right over the equator, this, of course, would mean 20 north and 20 south. Due to the inclination of the orbit, at times they are able to see slightly more than 30 degrees south of the equator, and one half revolution later, they will see a little more than 30 degrees north of the equator, each time at the expense of the other view.
Then how much of the, how wide of, what's the farthest north that they will have seen and the farthest south by the time they've made all 10 revs? They will, how much of the moon will they have surveyed, in effect? How big a band?
They will have had the opportunity, now we're speaking of a level moon, not mountain peaks. But on a level surface, they would have seen to about 32.5 degrees, I believe. Wasn't it 12.5 that the orbit inclination turned out to be 12.3? It'll be about 32.5 degrees to the south, which will generally be on the eastern side of the moon, and then in the on the western side of the moon, they will be to about 32.5 degrees north. Peaks will show up beyond that distance.
I have a couple of questions. Did I understand you to, did I understand someone to say this morning that the mass cons have had no effect whatsoever on the orbit, or is this uncertain yet?
Oh, no, no. They've affected the orbit, and I just gave some remarks as to how that shows up in a qualitative way. What exactly they did to the orbit, I don't have those numbers with me.
You don't know the deviation. No. The crater naming, was that all done here before the flight, or have they named any craters as they passed over them?
No, I think the intent of the names that were selected were just to give some identification for training and for making up the many maps that the men have to carry.
That was all done here?
I assume it was here.
Some, there were two named in orbit.
There were two names in orbit? Which were the names given in orbit?
Oh, the one Aaron and another
Pardon
one
me?
Dennis. Aaron and Dennis.
Would you repeat, Aaron?
A-A-R-O-N and Dennis.
Would you explain those again, please?
It's just that we pointed those two craters out on the screen. I remember pointing both of them out and saying, what's the name of that one going by now? And Bill said, oh, I don't know, call it John Aaron. That's essentially the way we've set up the whole designation system of our craters. There certainly can be no official number, name, or letter designated by us. But we had to use a number or some sort of designation for our craters we were going to use that are unnamed.
What is the... Would someone explain just exactly what landmark tracking is and why it's done?
Landmark tracking is simply an operation with the telescope, sextant equipment on board, similar to what was done in Apollo 7, only it is done over the selected areas that we intend to use as eventual landing sites when we go to the moon. Now, the intent of the exercise is to see how well the men can do that work and how accurately they can then determine where the site is relative to the orbit they're in. The problem, of course, when you go on a lunar landing mission is to be sure that when you start your descent, you're going down to the site you want to land at.
Okay, let's take Henry Simmons and go to this gentleman on the third row who's, I think, been waiting for a while.
On the LOI 2 burn, I was interested that the engine had burned about 10 or 20% longer than the planned value and yet had produced the requisite delta V change. Does that mean the engine is getting weaker?
No, as I said earlier, I think that just has to do with how accurately the time of the burn itself was noted. The job that the pilots have when they're doing a burn and monitoring one is fairly extensive, and it's pretty intensive also, as you could expect. And I think when the burn is over, they glance up at the clock and note what time it was. But to the nearest second or so, I wouldn't try to draw any conclusions from that reading.
This gentleman on the third row here.
During the TV pass,
If we can assume at any one point that the camera was pointed almost directly down, how large was the area we were seeing?
Want to try?
I don't know.
I don't know the lens characteristics well enough to give an answer to your specific question. At the time they were looking at Smythe Sea, however, they were seeing, and of course this was not straight down. This was probably a few degrees to several degrees off vertical. They were looking at an area that's about 15 lunar degrees in width. And
that's 16 miles a degree?
16 miles per degree, I believe it is.
Nautical miles, statute miles.
Close enough. I think it's 30 kilometers.
30 kilometers a degree.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
With reference to the previous question about landmark tracking, it sounded rather, as they were coming in, it sounded rather like they had done their homework pretty well, because I recall they were calling off their primary sites and secondary sites, and they were just naming off existing and known landmarks with a great deal of aplomb. I wonder if somebody could comment on this. It seems to me that the landmark tracking is almost superfluous here. I know it is.
No. First off, I think it's great that they can call them off like that, as they have to do the star fields and their navigation on the way to the moon. But the problem with the landmark tracking is mostly a matter of degree and accuracy, and that's what you're trying to get with the tracking itself as opposed to identification.
Let's take a question from the gentleman at the third row, and then I understand we have a couple of questions at the Cape. We'll switch there and then come back and wrap it up with a few more questions here.
Dr. Dietrich, you mentioned that you were pleased at their ability to observe detail at high sun angles. I wonder if this could do anything to, in future missions, to give you a wider launch window by perhaps lessening the lunar lighting constraint.
Yeah, okay.
That's a decision that someone else will have to make. The real nice thing about low sun angles is the fact that you can have a better judge of your height of objects that you're looking at. We had somewhat believed before I saw the TV this morning, that there would be a large area that was essentially washed out, where you could see very little detail. And that was the thing I was talking about. We still have a degraded vision, or a degraded ability to observe details at the high sun angles, but it's not as bad as we had thought.
Okay, let's switch to the Cape for a couple of questions.
Thanks, John. We've got two questions here. Pete Wright, Chicago's American gentleman. Gentlemen, can we have any idea of the emotional response of the astronauts to this fantastic adventure, becoming the first men to see the moon from close up?
Go ahead. We're ready.
The question was, do we have a feeling for the emotional response they had? I would certainly say it was one of jubilation, exultation, and any other word I can think of that would be synonymous with those. This is something they've worked many, many weeks and months on. One of the questions over here was how much homework had we done on landmark tracking and on our lunar landmarks. And let me assure you, there was a great deal of time put in on this, and I think part of the exaltation was just being able to see something and recognize it. And the more craters they saw and recognized, the more jubilant they became.
Hans Hofer, German press agency. Do you expect the astronauts to see Zoftlanders on the moon's surface? And if you do, which rev would offer the best opportunities for this?
I think the question was whether we would be able to see the spacecraft on the moon's surface from the Earth. Is that right? I'm not really prepared to answer that. As far as from the Earth in general goes, the lighting is essentially the same each rev when it comes around. I guess the only hope for seeing it would be that While the spacecraft would still be in sunlight, the moon below would be dark, and you would see a reflection of the spacecraft, some sun off the spacecraft, against the dark background of the moon when it was in shade. I have heard that some people are trying to actually catch that with the telescope, but I can't comment on it any more than that.
Thanks very much, but sorry, this was not what I had in mind. Do you expect the crew of Apollo 8, to see soft landers on the surface of the moon? I mean, surveyors, rangers, and so on. And if you do, in which revolution would you expect them to do it?
I don't know.
There is one surveyor craft that is just a few degrees on the dark side of the Terminator. This was our closest chance, and had the launch slipped a few days, we might have had an opportunity. As it is now, the spacecraft are on the dark side of the Terminator, and the answer is no, there's no chance.
Okay. Visibility of objects on the dark side of the Terminator, have they said anything about visibility? How dark it actually is?
They haven't said anything that I know of, Jerry, but I imagine it's pretty dark.
The only comment that I have heard along that line was while they were still over the sunlit surface, looking beyond the Terminator, I believe it was on the first revolution, there was a comment that we could not see in objects in Earthshine. But when they're flying above the glaring surface, I wouldn't expect them to have their night adaptation yet. So hopefully, but I haven't heard any word.
Harry, please.
A couple more questions on nomenclature. We've had John Aaron identified for us, but would you tell us who Mr. Dennis is and why he was sighted in flight?
John Aaron is one of the men who works over in the control center in the Moker. He's worked a lot of Gemini flights, and he's worked almost all the Apollo flights, and is real popular with all the pilots for his work.
Dennis is a young gentleman who works over in our neck of the woods in Flight Crew Systems Division. He was one of the real mainstays in the formulation of the checklist. And so the crew had naturally had quite a bit of contact with him, and when they needed a name quick to name one, the first one they thought of was Dennis.
Well, is it the first name?
That's his first name, Dennis Bentley.
His last name is
Bentley.
B-E-N-T-L-E-Y.
Right.
And,
what's the latitude longitude of Bentley?
this is what I did want to ask was, after the Russians got their first backside pictures, they named a bunch of blobs over there for people on their side of the world. And I think the IAU did ultimately accept those as official names. Now, do you have any intention to propose these to the International Astronomical Union as official names?
You know, Jeff?
I have no idea. I don't think there was any intent in the designation of these craters to formally propose these as names, because we just didn't feel it was a chance anyway. We only gave them these names because we wanted to, in some small way, give recognition to those who were really close to our Apollo 8 mission.
Dr. Dietrich, when were the names Borman, Lovell, Anders, Bassett, and C proposed, or when did they come up? Several months ago or just recently?
As far as my experience is concerned, I first saw them on a map about 3 days ago.
I saw them this morning when they handed me the map at the Capcom console.
Yeah, well, did you do it, sir?
No, sir.
Who did?
Flight Crew Support Group.
The crew did it.
The crew
did it.
The problem is, when you're trying to describe something, you need a handle. And the backside of the moon is almost without handles to hold on to.
But
so they had to have something.
But these were on the front side, weren't they?
No, sir. They're all, I believe every one of the named craters is beyond 90 degrees east.
That's right.
Or if not, it's very near 90 where we're looking at it flat on when we're looking at it with an Earth telescope so that you can see very little about the surface.
The Collins and Houston are about 92 and 95 respectively.
F. Clark.
Question for Dr. Dietrich. There was a reference, I think, by Lovell to craters with dark spots in the centers and with light, what looked like light dust around the rims. Could you draw any conclusions from that, or did it sound like what you've seen before in photographs? Did it add anything or raise your interest at all?
It raised my interest, particularly because there is a very small amount of normal dark-colored Mari material on the part of the moon that we have recently found out about from orbiter photographs, the back side, far side of it. He may have been referring, and I do not know for sure, he may have been referring to craters with dark floors of material something like this Mari deposit, but with lighter colored rim. This would be in line with, well, for instance, Copernicus on the front side is a very large crater with similar characteristics. I don't know the craters he was talking about.
Art Schneider.
On the matter of nomenclature again, isn't it the tradition of the IAU to name these objects after people who are deceased, and would this be a violation of that tradition?
I don't know the total rule list. I know that about a year and a half ago there was some discussion, and at that time one of the conditions was that if it was a person, the person would be deceased, but I do not know whether this is one of the rules.
Mark Bloom.
John, I just want to ask John, so we can all write our sidebars, is it possible we can get that map that Mr. Carr was referring to with the names on it, so we'll know where all these things are?
Well, let's see, at this point in time, I think we've only got a single copy, the one that Jerry's got, but why don't we look into the possibilities of reproduction? It's certainly available for perusal, I know.
Because it seems to be a point of interest, and it's going to get very confused, I think, if we don't get at least a good map like that.
We'll check into it right after the conference. Let's see, we've got time for about three or four more questions.
John, there are a number of numbers that we would like to get cleared up, and I think it's probably simpler if we could have you read some of them than if we all come up and try to do it individually, such as exact times on LOI 1 and 2, delta Vs on LOI 1 and 2, and so on. Do we have those available?
I believe that's one of our prime purposes for Mr. Pavelka's role with us today. Like, why don't we close it on that note, if you like?
Okay, I can begin by giving you the ignition time for the LOI-1 maneuver. It was 69 hours, 08 minutes, 19.5 seconds. The delta V of that maneuver was 2,996.8 feet per second. Let me give you those parameters on the LOI-2 maneuver, and I'd be happy if you would point me in the direction of other parameters that you're interested in. For LOI-2, the ignition time was 73 hours, 35 minutes, 05.7 seconds. The delta V for that maneuver was 135.2 feet per second. Those are generally the main points of interest. If you'll give me some questions, I'll fill you in.
First LOS and the first AOS, if you get that.
The first LOS was 68 hours, 58 minutes, 05 seconds. The first acquisition was 69 hours, 31 minutes, 45 seconds. The first acquisition, 69 hours, 31 minutes, 45 seconds.
Just one other one. Do you have a period for the new orbit so that we can estimate about what their orbital time is each time.
While he's getting there, it's very close to 2 hours. If that helps any. Do you have an exact number?
So the burns, too.
I think you hit the magic number that I don't have in my pocket here. 2 hours is the number we use as a rule of thumb, and it's very close. It's within several minutes.
I said like burns.
Did you have the duration of the two burns?
Okay. The burn time for the LOI-1 burn was 4 minutes, 02.36 seconds. The burn time for LOI-2 was 9.34 seconds.
One more for history, if I may. It got a little confused at this point. Does anyone have the exact first words from lunar orbit and who said them?
Why don't you take that, Jerry?
As I remember, the first words on acquisition came from Jim Lovell. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact words, but I know that it involved the what we call the burn status report. The first item on the burn status report is whether the ignition went off on time. And as I remember, the very next thing he said was what the paracentian and apacentian were. And I believe, did you write those down, Glenn? He called them out as...
Yeah, he called out about 61 and 169.
Yeah, they were so close that everybody just gasped. They were so close to being right smack on the button.
Okay, on that historic note, let's close it.